agency Garrison was firmly convinced was behind the assassination. The CIA is a major menace to the democracy I thought we lived in, he told the press. Joan Mellon's A Farewell to Justice, Jim Garrison, JFK's Assassination, and the Case That Should Have Changed History. This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen, October 11th, our special three-hour broadcast for a discussion with Joan Mellon about her newly published book, Hot Off the Presses, A Farewell to Justice, Jim Garrison, JFK's Assassination, and the Case That Should Have Changed History. We have discussed in the past 2 hours that Lee Harvey Oswald is not a lone assassin, was a government agent, CIA, FBI, U.S. Customs, and that Lee Harvey Oswald knew David Ferry, worked closely with him and with Clay Shaw, that there was the planning and the implementation of the Kennedy assassination centered here in New Orleans as well as in Dallas, and Joan follows the Louisiana connections. And also we're going to discuss the setting up. We've discussed the setting up of Oswald as a patsy, but also Joan uncovered a second patsy.
But before we get to the second patsy, I want to make reference to the following. Richard Case Nigel, Joan, we've discussed him. Garrison believed that Nigel was, as you put it, the closest thing to the key to the assassination that there is in one man. The CIA had assigned Nigel to surveil Oswald in New Orleans in the summer of 63. And then Nagel uncovered the plot to murder Kennedy. If you find out what I had to do with Oswald, and he had to do it with me, you will know what this is all about. You have Nagel writing to Richard Hopkin. But let's just look at him a moment. A military intelligence officer with the Counterintelligence Corps of the U.S. Army, recruited to the Central Intelligence Agency, first meeting Oswald in Japan. Nagel worked for the CIA Red Squad, spying on dissident organizations. He was investigating associates of what he called the right-wing extremist David Ferry, and he was referring to none other than Sergio Arcacha Smith. Nagel went to Louisiana as Oswald's manager. He connected Arcacha Smith with Eladio Del Valle, who would be murdered in Miami after Jim Garrison was preparing to indict him. And he defined himself as having a special mission. He stated that the Ferry Bannister group, which he had infiltrated, was Oswald's circle, and that these were the central people in preparing the murder of John F. Kennedy. And here we have Nagel writing to J. Edgar Hoover on September 17th, warning that Kennedy was about to be assassinated, naming Oswald's aliases, and then writing to Desmond Fitzgerald at JM Wave, in which he returns money that was to have been supplied to Oswald. Garrison wanted to interview Nagel. What happened? What did William Martin do? How was that sabotaged?
Garrison thought that Nagel would be the best witness he had. But just to make a long story short, and I tell it in the book, Nagel finally refused to testify at the trial of Clay Shaw that the agency for which he worked was the CIA. And that made him really not a usable witness. So after all was said and done, it was really not William Martin. William Martin was one of the plants in Garrison's office that we referred to in the last segment, and clearly had worked for the CIA before he entered Garrison's office as an assistant district attorney, and later immediately called the CIA as soon as he left. And Garrison, because William Martin spoke Spanish, now I can't figure out why would that be the reason that he sent him to see Richard Case Nagel. But anyway, I think Martin had volunteered. He was going to go interview Richard Case Nagel, who at that time was in Springfield Prison, which was a federal psychiatric prison. And Richard Case Nagel immediately saw that William Martin was CIA connected. But ultimately, Richard Case Nagel, what's important about him, I think, is his analysis of the situation, the fact that he knew Ferry, he knew Shaw, and he knew that Richard Helms was behind the assassination, and he knew that John F. Kennedy was threatening the power of the CIA, and that this was the motive. This is something that we haven't talked about so much in today, that the motive of the CIA in destroying John F. Kennedy had to do with Kennedy's challenge to the CIA, which, as President Truman said in an op-ed piece on the front page of the Washington Post 1 month after the assassination, that the CIA was running a shadow government. And John F. Kennedy had made serious inroads in reducing the power of the CIA, reducing the power of the Director of Central Intelligence, reducing the activities that they were involved in, reducing their budget. And as a result of this, the CIA really was not just angry at Kennedy because of his policies, but because the very institution was threatened. And Richard K. Snegel, in a series of letters that he wrote to a friend in Mexico, reveals that he knew all of this. And he knew that Richard Helms was behind the assassination. Plus, his surveillance of Oswald and his knowledge of the foreknowledge of the assassination led him to be, would have been, a remarkable witness. And I should tell the audience, we didn't mention, is that when Richard K. Snegel realized that the assassination of President Kennedy was being planned and that Oswald was going to be involved in it in some way, he went to a bank in El Paso and shot off a gun, and which you do in a bank meant that that was a federal crime, and it was he was immediately put in prison, which meant that if he were in prison, he knew that he could not be implicated himself in the assassination. That's how close to the assassination plot that he came. Unfortunately, even later, years later, when Richard K. Snegel was about to testify before the House Select Committee, he dies. And so he never actually revealed all that he knew, although a remarkable book was written about Richard K. Snegel called The Man Who Knew Too Much by Dick Russell.
Right. Now, it's interesting, you see here, that we're describing Kennedy's designs upon the Central Intelligence Agency Covert Operations Division that was outside his control. But the operations to murder Fidel Castro were not something to which he took exception, and he was seeking to have... Wasn't he indeed the Kennedy brothers obsessed with James Bond and covert operations themselves, except they wanted to run them?
Well, I don't really believe that Kennedy's policies were what the CIA was so disturbed about. Of course, it ultimately comes to that, that the CIA operating, and I think we need to make a statement that the CIA does not operate alone as an institution, but rather represents the views of the Pentagon. Certainly it did during Kennedy's time, and that both the Pentagon and the CIA favored a ground war, which John F. Kennedy opposed. It wasn't that he was a Democratic or that he opposed the idea of fighting in Vietnam, but rather he believed that covert operations were the answer, special forces, Green Berets, and that if this didn't work, he would go in for coalition government in Vietnam on the style of what he had in Laos. He did not want, and the Pentagon favoring that ground war, of course, got that war as soon as Kennedy was out of the way.
You mentioned Richard Helms. Could you discuss his role in the Kennedy assassination?
Well, we don't have, and I think I wouldn't claim to have, a scene in my book in which Richard Helms plans with various group of people whose names we know the assassination. But certainly the assassination emanated from the clandestine services of which Richard Helms, as deputy director for plans, was at the head. And I also want to emphasize the enormous participation of the Office of the General Counsel, Lawrence Houston, in all of these events. Houston even went so far as to subvert a potential Garrison witness in the Shaw trial, whose name was Alfred J. Moran, and right, who was one of those witnesses who was a CIA asset, worked for J.M. Wave, and could have testified that he saw Clay Shaw at the Eastern Airlines terminal on the day when the name Clay Bertrand appears in the guest registration book, which would have meant that Garrison had the proof beyond any doubt that Clay Shaw was the man who called Dean Andrews as Clay Bertrand and said, please go to Dallas to represent Lee Harvey Oswald. And the CIA made a tremendous effort. Alfred J. Moran, who had no particular admiration for Jim Garrison, went to a cocktail party the night after Garrison's office interviewed him and said, Jim Garrison has an ironclad case. And what the CIA did after that was to do everything in its power to make sure that that statement by Alfred J. Moran was erased, and that Alfred J. Moran would then give another statement for the record saying that he didn't really mean it and he had faith in it. Garrison didn't know what he was talking about and that he did not see Clay Shaw at the Eastern Airlines terminal.
I just wanted to go back again to the conflicts at the highest levels of state with Kennedy and the CIA, because you write here, in May of 1961, only a month after the Bay of Pigs, Kennedy formed his own special group, meeting is the President's Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board. Its express purpose was to bring the CIA under the control of the President. Quote, covert action programs of the CIA may not have been worth the risk nor worth the great expenditure of manpower and money, Kennedy told the group on May 15th. So what he wanted was his own covert operations group. You say General Maxwell Taylor, whom he appointed Special Assistant for Intelligence, was to be on top of covert operations. Because you were talking before about how Robert Kennedy had his own anti-Castro assassination team and plans, and here we have Kennedy wanting his own CIA operations, much the way now that Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld was trying to bypass the role of the CIA with his own covert operations group under the Pentagon.
Well, which they've succeeded in doing. But I want to quote one of the soldiers of fortune. Ralph mentioned Gerald Patrick Hemming, who remarked to me one day, John F. Kennedy was the last president who thought he could take power. And I think that's really true. I mean, after all, Kennedy was president. He really thought that policymaking would be his and that the CIA would not be making contradictory policies to his own, apart from his general agreement that it would have been better for that thorn in his side in Cuba to be done away with.
Now, you remember that both Helms and James Jesus Angleton were defining figures in setting the platform and the program for what amounts to the murder of the head of state. And, of course, that Hemming had stated Helms is behind the entire operation to kill JFK. And, indeed, you cite Nagel himself as saying, Dirty Dick Helms ran CIA's dirty tricks. He was the person who gave the order for John F. Kennedy's murder. And this view was shared by Colonel William Bishop, Nagel's CIA associate, who said Richard Helms gave the order for the assassination.
When Nagel refers to dirty tricks, he's referring there to the clandestine services of the CIA.
Right. And Angleton, after all, had been a pivotal figure here, both with regard to the false defector program, which entailed Lee Harvey Oswald, and the counterintelligence operations, and working very much hand in glove with covert operations in all of this. Is that not correct?
Yes.
Let's talk a moment about the extraordinary revelation that you have made in this book about the second Patsy, the rabbi.
Thomas Edward Beckham is the figure about whom Ralph is speaking. He enters the story very early on when Jack Martin, whom I establish in this book, was a longtime CIA operative. Jack Martin mentions him as someone Garrison should look into. Garrison brought Beckham ultimately before his grand jury, and I think one of the aspects of this book that's brand new are the scenes in Omaha, where Thomas Edward Beckham is moving between Nebraska and Iowa and to a safe house in Iowa run by the CIA in attempt to evade the subpoena from Orleans Parish. Eventually, however, Jack Martin calls Beckham and tells him to go back to Nebraska, and he's caught, and he's sent to Orleans Parish. And he testifies to the grand jury and lies. Every word he says practically is a lie. And it's left at that. Years later, I guess a decade later, the House Select...
What was he being asked to...
Well, he was asked about Guy Bannister, about Lee Harvey Oswald, about Clay Shaw, and in fact, he knew all of these things. He knew all of these people. He certainly knew that Shaw knew Ruby, for example. Garrison didn't even know at that time what Beckham would reveal to the House Select Committee, which was that he was present at meetings in Algiers, again a name we all know now, and at the Town and Country Motel, which was owned by Carlos Marcello, discussing the assassination, that he was present at those meetings. Garrison did not yet know that Thomas Edward Beckham was given an assignment from David Ferry's lawyer, G. Ray Gill, to take a big bunch of maps, diagrams, and materials about Dealey Plaza to Dallas to put into the hands of a soldier of fortune who worked for the CIA named Lawrence Howard the week before the assassination. So he was really a courier for the people who were involved in the assassination of John F. Kennedy. The House Select Committee interviewed him several times and got a certain amount of information about these meetings. And when I talked to Robert Burris and L.J. Delsa, they encouraged me to try to find Beckham and to see what more he could tell me. And so I eventually, through the help of his daughter, who lives in New Orleans, tracked him down. And then he told me of how, I would say, some months during the year 1963, he had a post office box in the same post office where Lee Harvey Oswald had his post office box and many of these other CIA assets had theirs. And he was given a ticket to go to Virginia. And he was taken to the CIA training facility, and he was trained to be a CIA asset, I suppose. He was, and the reason that they liked him, and there's a document that he gave me that no one has seen, and that his own handler, Fred Chrisman, gave him, which shows why he was of such interest to the CIA, and it said that he had no psychological guilt with respect to killing. So we can see that he was the kind of person that they could set up. And I should say that prior to this, in his early days, Jack Martin had tried to have him committed to mental facilities, mental health facilities in Mandeville and in New Orleans itself, exactly the same pattern that was used with Lee Harvey Oswald, where Oswald was going to get a job at the East Louisiana State Hospital at Jackson. The same thing happened to Beckham. He was a figure whom no one would miss. And so forth. And that's really parallel to the type of assassin that the CIA had cultivated.
What was Beckham doing in New Orleans?
Beckham was from New Orleans. And Beckham was a singer. He was a country singer who sang under the name of Mark Evans. And when the House Select Committee, in a very hostile deposition, questioned him, it was Mark C. Evans. And they asked what the C stood for. And he was, even though he had never gone beyond the third grade in school, he answered, the C stands for country. And he said that he was part of the Louisiana Hayride, which was a famous, I don't want to call it a rock concert. It was folk singing. In the early days, they discovered Johnny Cash. Elvis Presley sang up there, and it emanated out. It was live radio emanating out of Shreveport. So he sang there, and he was just a courier, a runner, a person who was attached to Guy Bannister's office. And Beckham's father had put him in the hands of Jack Martin because Jack Martin had promised that he would help him in his singing career.
Remember that Jack Martin is a Central Intelligence Agency operative working out of Guy Bannister's office and with Guy Bannister.
And I must say that I'm the first to write that.
That's correct. But here is an extraordinary revelation that emerges from your meetings and discussions with Rabbi Thomas Beck. What kind of conditioning and what kind of tests did they do on Beckham at Langley? If anybody has seen the Parallax view of Alan Pakula with Warren Beatty regarding the assassination of a senator and the way in which they program assassins and break them down, you would have thought that they had a blueprint of what occurred at Langley as you describe it. Why don't you give it a...
Well, I think it was exactly as Ralph says, as in the movie The Parallax View, where pictures are flashed on the wall and you have to give free association of ideas. You're taken through a labyrinth of rooms and you're asked to remember what you saw and you're taught how not to reveal anything about yourself. You're taught not to smoke tobacco because the scent of the tobacco would give you away. And there were a whole series of, I guess, what we would call tradecraft that he was taught.
Right, you write in here... He was taught how to create false information. He's instructed never to volunteer an opinion on any issue. He must not brag about anything he has done. He must never talk about anything he has done in the past. He is taught to have only short conversations with people. And you mentioned that he meets somebody who has one white eyebrow. And
that's Robert Buras, to whom the book is dedicated, the police officer. And Robert Buras was interviewing him for the House Select Committee. So Thomas Edward Beckham said to me, you know, I really didn't like that white eyebrow. He should really have gotten rid of that because it gave him away. It was very amusing, actually. I told Buras about that.
In relation to this, Joan, we must reprise here. Beckham is groomed as a second patsy. He's a courier, as you say. He's carrying military diagrams of Dealey Plaza to the intended assassins, the actual killers. He is present during the meetings that include the central figures that we're discussing here, that Jim Garrison was, in fact, on the trail of, when he writes his book, On the Trail of the Assassins. That's who he's talking about. There's a very poignant part of your description of the role of Beckham, and particularly your interaction with Beckham.
I want to describe that, Ralph. I think what you're referring to is after Beckham testified to Garrison's grand jury, which he denied everything. He denied that he knew Jack Martin, even, who was his handler. He denied that he knew Oswald, and so he denied that he had anything to do with the CIA. Well, according to Beckham, what he told me was after that grand jury appearance, and he went home, he got a telephone call from Jim Garrison. And the person that was with him, that stuck to him like glue, was a person named A. Roswell Thompson, who was a figure in the Ku Klux Klan in Louisiana. And so blatant was the Klan in Louisiana that A. Roswell Thompson walked around in his the white sheets. Once a year, he would wear the white sheets in public with the pointed hat, and he would go to Lee's Circle and put a wreath at the foot of the statue of Robert E. Lee. And I think the best photograph I have in this book, and there are many photographs, is the figure of Robert Burris, the police officer, as I mentioned, to whom the book is dedicated, standing next to A. Roswell Thompson in his Klan robes, protecting his civil liberties. Because as a police officer, everybody's throwing rocks and, you know, in outrage that here's Roswell Thompson walking around as a Klanner. And Robert Burris is protecting A. Roswell Thompson. Well, this same A. Roswell Thompson was with Thomas Edward Beckham on that day after Beckham testified before the grand jury. And Garrison calls up and says, listen, just tell me, was I close? And Beckham really doesn't want to admit to anything. And he says, why ask me? I don't know anything, and so forth. And what Beckham said to me, this is a couple of years ago when I did the interview, I wish I could have told him. I wish I could have told him how close he was.
It's not just how close he was, but how right on he was, right on target.
And Beckham, too, was frightened. He ran. He was a con man, and he ran from place to place. He could never settle down. He thought that the CIA was after him. And he lived that life until, really, the last few years.
Describe the revelations that Beckham has made to you and his role as a rabbi, which is an extraordinary transformation.
Well, he was half-Jewish. His mother was Jewish, which I think makes you maybe all Jewish. And he became a rabbi. And his mother had always wanted one of her sons to, in fact, in the CIA document that he, well, it's not really a CIA document. It's an Army Air Defense document. But it refers to his CIA training. And it mentions that he's one of several brothers, implying that he wouldn't be missed in the family if anything happened to him, which was when they were thinking of using him as the patsy. And in later years, he became a rabbi, a practicing rabbi, and a person that dedicated himself to religion, and really trying to, I think, redeem himself, as many figures in this book did. Another one of the figures who tried to redeem himself, whom we haven't mentioned this afternoon, was a character called E. Carl McNabb, who was a CIA contract pilot. He also flew in the Congo. He murdered, during that time, I think if people remember, many nuns were murdered by... there was CIA bombings, and this fellow McNabb was involved in that. And years later, he tried to redeem himself by offering Jim Garrison his assistance. And he was nicknamed by a former FBI figure who helped Garrison, named Bill Turner, Jim, for Jim Garrison, and Rose, because I think the Rose Bowl was on at that time. And Jim Rose tried to help Jim Garrison, I think in part to redeem himself for those murderous CIA missions that he flew, many of them into Cuba, many of them where he risked his life, was shot down in the Caribbean. And one time he said he was shot down because we were talking about the flight of John F. Kennedy Jr. And McNabb was a crackerjack aviator. He just said he wouldn't have gone. But he described to me how he landed a plane at one point in the sea, in the Caribbean, one foot on the rudder, one foot in the water, and sat on a rock and waited for Radio Swan to come and get him. And another fact that I enjoyed very much was to find out that John F. Kennedy sent Richard Goodwin down to Gerald Patrick Hemming and these soldiers of fortune and No Name Key and asked them, would they please help him? Would they please take over Radio Swan and take it away from the CIA? Hemming refused.
And what you're talking about here is John F. Kennedy trying to enlist these contract killers, these CIA killers, as his own team, which is, I think, illuminating.
But also, I should say that their loyalty was to the CIA and not to the President of the United States, and they didn't do it.
And wasn't it David Atlee Phillips who was in
yes,
charge
in fact,
of Radio
Swan?
Yes,
that's right. Very good, Maya. That's right. Radio Swan was a project of David Atlee Phillips.
Could you describe what Radio Swan
was? Radio Swan was a propaganda, like we would think of Radio Free Europe, where American propaganda is broadcast to Cuba.
Ruling class propaganda, but
well. But also, yeah, of course, also when the CIA pilots got in trouble, Radio Swan would radio for help to rescue them.
But what I want to emphasize here for our listeners is that these are not just local yokels here. You are talking about hard contract killers in covert ops that involved the deaths of many and the hunting down of people. And Joan enters into the lair, encounters them, succeeds in inducing them to come forward and has made the record. I mean, the revelations that emerge from her meetings with Angela Mergado, or not to mention Jerry Patrick Hemming.
Beckham.
Or with Thomas Edwin Beckham. She has actually induced to come forward in full particularity and with documentation. Nothing before had succeeded in inducing this man to come forward. This is a person who, as Joan has described, lived his life in fear of his own elimination, because so many of the people who had guilty knowledge were quickly removed from the scene. They were found dead from karate chops, from heart attacks, from hatchet in the head. They don't survive long. There's a four-volume work called Forgive My Grief by Penn Jones, which details some of this. Here's Joan in the lion's den, as it were, coming back with the evidence and the documentation and drawing the full political meaning of it in A Farewell to Justice.
We've been speaking with Joan Mellon about her book, soon to be released, A Farewell to Justice, Jim Garrison, JFK's Assassination, and the Case That Should Have Changed History. Ralph?
When we were describing the revelations that emerged out of the investigative work that was initiated in Italy by Paesi Serra, one of the emergent structures that elucidates how the ruling class effects its control was this strange thing called Centro Mondiale Commerciale, or World Trade Mart. There's the International Trade Mart in New Orleans, Clay Shaw, who has been involved in the Permindex and the Centro Mondiale Commerciale at the center of the International Trade Mart in New Orleans. Where do you think John Kennedy was having lunch that day in Dallas, at the International Trade Mart in Dallas? What do you think determined the motorcade route, sent it to this obscure plaza, Dealey Plaza? What was Jim Garrison focusing on when he noted that Major General Charles Cabot, the deputy director of the Central Intelligence Agency, who was obligated to leave the CIA with the firing of Allen Dulles, had a brother who was the mayor of Dallas and the father and grandfather before them? When we went to see Jim in 1969, what was Jim focusing on, Joan?
Jim was focusing on the Cabals. Jim was focusing on the fact that John F. Kennedy had fired Allen Dulles, and Dulles' second-in-command, General Cabell, resigned immediately as a result, and that his brother turned out to have been the mayor of Dallas at the time that John F. Kennedy was killed. And Jim, even when I last saw Jim Garrison, was in 1989. I was in New Orleans doing research on the biography of Kay Boyle, and Garrison was still talking about General Cabell and the parade route and the assassination. And I should say that at that time, he had a bestseller, On the Trail of the Assassins. The movie JFK was being made. But these things didn't interest him half as much as the details that he had discovered about the Kennedy assassination. I think that Jim Garrison was, and I hope I conveyed in my book, his humor when people asked him how he thought that he could prosecute somebody from the Central Intelligence Agency involved in the assassination in a conspiracy in a state court in Louisiana. Jim Garrison said, "I guess I thought I was living in the country I was born in." And I think that's about my favorite Garrison line. He liked to say that as if he were incredulous. This is not the country. It was not the country he was born in. And we today are not living in the country we were born in. And I think part of that flows from the cover-up and the lies that the American public was told about the Kennedy assassination. And when Jim Garrison, who had nothing to gain from this, as Ralph said, when he decided to investigate, he too was vilified. He was accused of being everything in those days. It was the worst thing you could say about someone was that he was homosexual. He was accused of having died of AIDS. You know, after he died, it must have been of AIDS. And he was the mafia. Everything that you could possibly say, that he also didn't protect the rights of defendants, which was not true. It was Sheridan who didn't protect the right of the defendant, Jimmy Hoffa. It was not Garrison. Garrison always protected people's rights. And Garrison refused to prosecute, as I said earlier, on issues of homosexuality, on issues of obscenity. When James Baldwin's novel, Another Country, was seized by police officers and taken out of the Doubleday bookstores in New Orleans, Garrison refused to prosecute, and he constantly defended civil liberties. And when Ralph and I were in New Orleans, I should say, in 1969, when we walked down the street, every African-American practically that we passed said hello to Mr. Garrison. I couldn't understand why, because I didn't understand at the time, that Garrison got his support and was elected three times as district attorney of Orleans Parish because the black community supported him, the black leadership supported him, and the union supported him, not the other citizens of the city. And he won even, and I should say won re-election, even after Clayshaw was acquitted. And I also want to add, Ralph, that when you talked about the case, when the Department of Justice brought Garrison to trial for supposedly having taken bribes from pinball gambling interests, pinball gambling was illegal at the time. What happened at the trial was that it turned out that there was a big man at Tulane and Broad, and Tulane and Broad was the place where the criminal court was. Oh, yes, there was a big man at Tulane and Broad who was taking bribes, but it was not Jim Garrison. It turned out to have been the chief of police, Joe Giarrusso, and what the federal government had to do was to bring Giarrusso before a federal grand jury. Garrison gave his closing statement. He eventually represented himself at his lawyer's suggestion. And Garrison talked about himself and about his life. Old children were sitting in the front row. And he said, the last perfect person lived on Earth 2,000 years ago.
I wanted you to give an account of who was Pershing Gervais and how did the Justice Department deploy him to destroy Jim Garrison.
Clear thing in the documentation that Joan goes into in this book is the collaboration of major media, Newsweek, NBC, and other newspapers with the FBI in the attempt to discredit Jim Garrison and the investigation into the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. That is why it is so important to have WBAI and to have a forum, an opportunity for Ralph Schoenman and myself and to have Joan Mellon on this program, because here that you're going to hear the truth. Ralph.
Pershing Gervais.
This is a Shakespearean story. It's Garrison being betrayed by his best friend. And I think also we should say, although Pershing Gervais was really, he was an ex-cop who was totally corrupt, and Garrison made him his chief investigator when Garrison first was elected district attorney in 1962, because he said, well, he needs somebody who knows the streets. Well, Pershing knew the streets, and Pershing took bribes from various nightclubs and places and cafes and so forth. And ultimately what happened was that Walter Sheridan, who was never through with Garrison, even after Clayshaw was acquitted, Department of Justice tried to destroy Garrison. And Walter Sheridan came back to New Orleans and threatened Pershing Gervais. At that time, Gervais had been out of Garrison's office for years. And he said that we'll put you in jail on income tax evasion. And we have these documents, thanks to the JFK Act, unless you wiretap Jim Garrison and help us. And so Gervais used a tape recorder, and of course these tapes were all spliced and they were all altered, but he betrayed Garrison. And then at the end he decided nobody could control Pershing Gervais, certainly not the United States government. He was a law unto himself. And so finally, just as they were about to go to trial, Pershing, who was now in Canada under a witness protection program with a fake name, called his best friend reporter in New Orleans, a woman named Rosemary James, and asked her to come up to Vancouver where he was, and said that he had been trying to frame Garrison at the direction of the Department of Justice, that Garrison wasn't guilty, that all the tapes were incorrect, and that Garrison didn't have a nickel, and that everybody knew that. And, of course, the case then was really not going to be won. Garrison won it because of that. And when Pershing finally, the Department of Justice forced him to be a rebuttal witness, it didn't do any good.
Well, what you're talking about here is the suborning of perjury, the conscious and deliberate attempt on the part of Sheridan and the U.S. Department of Justice to frame Jim Garrison on a fabricated charge by suborning the perjury of a corrupt figure and creating scissors and paste splice tapes to establish the guilt of Jim Garrison of something of which he had not been guilty at all, taking bribes for the use of pinball machines in New Orleans, the absurdity of it.
I want to just quote, this is a quote from James Angleton, which I think was sort of close to his death, and I got it from a book by Joseph Trento, which I think sums up the activities of some of the CIA figures in our story that we've talked about this afternoon. It's something that James Angleton told Joe Trento, I think. Alan Dulles, Richard Helms, Carmel Offey, and Frank Wisner. And Frank Wisner was the person who had collected a French Nodge to be one of the CIA assets, the person who would eventually be one of the founders of Permandex. Alan Dulles, Richard Helms, Carmel Offey, and Frank Wisner were the grandmasters. If you were in a room with them, you were in a room full of people that you had to believe would deservedly end up in hell. I guess I will see them there soon. Now, I don't know. You can't call that quite a deathbed confession, but it's awfully close.
Well, Joan, you remember that James Jesus Angleton, who was the head of counterintelligence and covert operations, had a drinking problem. He appeared before some reporters once, and he was drunk, and he made the following statement. He says, "There are many rooms in the mansion. I wasn't privy to who shot John." But, of course, he was more than privy.
Well, he was in the same mansion in any case.
Yes.
The one we're talking about. And I also, and I'm not going to quote it now, but it's in the book. I have a semi-deathbed confession by Clay Shaw, where he's visited his hospital. He was dying of lung cancer, and he told a French Quarter artist, George Duro, that Garrison was wrong, but someone like me might well have helped the CIA, might well have delivered a package, might well. He really does describe exactly what he did in the Kennedy assassination, aiding and abetting, being part of the conspiracy, certainly not a shooter, certainly it was not his idea that John F. Kennedy be murdered, but willing to participate.
Well, after all, in terms of deathbed confessions, we have the example of David Attlee Phillips himself.
David Attlee Phillips, estranged from his brother and near death himself, talked to his brother. And this was relayed to me by David Attlee Phillips' nephew, Sean, and also was relayed to Dick Russell, saying that were you in Dealey Plaza, and pretty much admitting that he was in Dealey Plaza on November 22nd, not shooting, of course, but superintending. Another person who apparently was at Dealey Plaza, Bernardo de Torres, whom we mentioned earlier, was Leopoldo, the visitor to Sylvia Odio.
So we have here in the confluence of these various people in charge of the covert ops and intelligence agencies, the truth emerging in spite of themselves, not only in their own words, but in the documents that establish their role. And in that regard, we have not just the role of the Justice Department, the CIA, and we have to keep in mind that a key figure in all of this was J. Edgar Hoover. And one of the other extraordinary things that emerges from this book is the
Mark
role as Mark Felt. Not only J. Edgar Hoover, but specifically Mark Felt, the so-called deep throat. Would you describe what you have disclosed here about the role of Mark Felt in relation to these events?
Mark Felt was one of the people in the FBI charged with discrediting Jim Garrison. And he worked with the second-in-command to the Attorney General for the state of Louisiana, Jack P.F. Gremillion, trying to find dirt on Jim Garrison. And I discussed that really in the introduction to the book because to get an idea, the whole FBI was involved in the discrediting of Jim Garrison. One of the things that J. Edgar Hoover did as soon as Garrison started was to issue a directive to all special agents in charge to say, give Garrison nothing. And we have that in writing.
Yes, and of course, in relation to this, we were mentioning at the beginning of this program, Joan, the fate of such as Mary Sherman. And of course, we know that right after the disclosure that Perry was going to be indicted, he was found dead. There was a specific area of work in which both these people were engaged. It had to do with cancer. Would you describe it?
I'm not going to say too much about Mary Sherman and about her experiments, that she worked clearly in a government lab in the dead of night. Mary Sherman worked for the Ochsner Clinic. And Alton Ochsner was a very close associate of Clay Shaw, both of them CIA assets. There are enormous number of CIA documents about Dr. Ochsner. Somehow Mary Sherman is connected to the Ochsner Clinic, connected to Ferry, connected to the U.S. Public Health Hospital, where Oswald himself was carrying a vaccination card when he was arrested in Dallas. And that card came from that hospital. And I wish that people would find in my book many hints that they could continue this investigation. My book is not the be-all and the end-all. I hope I've opened up areas of investigation for people to go further, to look further, to find new witnesses, to encourage new witnesses to come forward. It's what Jim Garrison always wanted. He hoped that by Perry Russo coming forward and being public, other people would also come forward. And I think this is all we can hope for. And I find that I was very lucky, really, when I was in Miami. I'm looking at the book, and I find another soldier of fortune, Edward I. Arthur, who's well known to people who have studied the anti-Castro movement. And Edward I. Arthur told me he was warned by his CIA controller during the summer in Miami, the summer of 1963, this guy Oswald, if you come across him, stay away. And another CIA colleague at the time told Ed Arthur, Kennedy's not long for this world. So the idea that this was really an open secret, that the CIA was after Kennedy. As Maya said, the mainstream press has preferred to accept the Warren Commission report, although I think the polls overwhelmingly state that nobody really believes that Oswald acted alone. But the evidence is overwhelming, not only that what we know today, but even what was known at the time.
Now, it's the entire panoply of events, because they had placed Oswald in Mexico City, and this under the direction of such as David Attlee Phillips. What was he doing there?
I'm going to leave the Mexico City portion of the story to others. I concentrate in my book on the events that happened during Oswald's stay in Louisiana from April of 1963 to the end of September, shortly before he goes to visit Sylvia Odio. You see all the cast of characters, the CIA, David Ferry, and David Ferry's role, I should also add, we haven't had a chance to mention, was to carry people out of Dallas, if needed, right after the assassination and fly them to places in Latin America.
And that very plan of Ferry to take the assassins out and the movements of Ferry in relation to Galveston and Dallas was the subject of meetings for which there were witnesses and part of the extraordinary documentation in A Farewell to Justice.
One of the people I found, and I never dreamed that I would, was a friend of David Ferry's called John Wilson. And John Wilson had seen Lee Harvey Oswald giving out his leaflets on Canal Street. And then John Wilson was visiting Ferry at his apartment, and who should he see there but the same fellow who had been giving out the leaflets. And he said, well, what's he doing at Dave's? So in case anybody doubted Perry Russo that he did see Lee Harvey Oswald up there, here's John Wilson, who really hasn't been involved with this case at all, has talked to no writers or has been interviewed by no government bodies, reporting on what happened.
And you describe many participants in gatherings, shall we call them, at Clayshaw's residence, in which they were deep in discussion about the assassination, witnesses to Perry, witnesses to Oswald, witnesses to Shaw, present together, and then in later meetings with Bannister. By the time you come to the vast number of witnesses you've produced and the evidence and documents of their meetings and their discussions, there isn't a scintilla of doubt as to the mechanism and the method and the implementation of the execution of John Kennedy.
Lee Harvey Oswald was not a loner, he was a government agent. Joan reveals that not just a government agent for the CIA and the FBI, but involved with U.S. Customs. And she goes into Oswald's operations for these agencies. He's closely connected with the anti-Castro figures in New Orleans. It's a total mythology about Oswald being in favor of Castro. That was the cover-up to set him up as a patsy, of which he wasn't aware. This included Clay Shaw, who Garrison prosecuted, David Ferry, and a Cuban associate of Shaw's at the International Trademark named Juan Valdez. There's an enormous cast of characters. Joan goes into the role of the FBI and of Attorney General Robert Kennedy to obstruct the investigation, planting people into the Garrison crew of investigators, working with the major media, Newsweek, NBC, and other publications to discredit Jim Garrison, going so far as to prosecute Jim Garrison, the district attorney, and later who became judge in New Orleans.
Yes, Maya. Jackals for the CIA, Chapter 17. In Jackals for the CIA, you will find person after person exposed for their CIA connections who are connected to Oswald and who were involved on behalf of the authorities in framing Oswald and in establishing the cover story for the execution of the president. The imputation to a presumptive Marxist for the purpose of a political adventure, that was the real underlying context of the assassination itself. This is a revelation, this book, and it is not just a revelation, but it is an establishing documentation of what actually occurred. Please, support it, obtain it, promote it, disseminate it, make it your own, and let's continue this struggle, brothers and sisters. A farewell to justice defines what occurred in relation to the execution of the head of state, but it also describes our subsequent history and the period during which we are living at this very moment. For all of the events that define the execution of the head of state provide the platform for the conduct of our affairs, for the treatment of our citizens, and for the nature of the state apparatus that has control over us. The martial law state has its roots in the murder of Kennedy. The hegemony of the military and the Central Intelligence Agency in our lives and the destruction of the formal protections that we have taken to be our birthright are a direct lineage with the execution of the head of state, and not just the cover-up, but the internalization of all of those processes and the embrace of treason at the highest levels. Joan is going to be talking about a farewell to justice across the United States. Support that effort. Carry on the struggle, brothers and sisters.
Tatan ta chinda karo tatan ta bilon lok ni wala gane